Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the DNC wants to boost voter registration in Arizona, where Democrats have been losing ground for years.
And remembering the controversial patriarch of a musical dynasty. But first, last year, Arizona voters passed a new law aimed at giving residents some recourse when their property is impacted by homelessness. Say there's an encampment near your house. Prop 312 allows you to apply for a property tax refund for some damages from your local government. The Goldwater Institute backed the initiative and describes it on their website as a response to your local government's, quote, refusal to enforce basic public health and safety laws. But our first guest this morning says the city of Tucson, at least, is routinely rejecting residents who apply for relief. Tim Steller is an opinion columnist for the Arizona Daily Star, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning to you.
So most of the complaints under this new law, it sounds like, have come from Tucson. What are folks complaining about?
Oh, largely they're saying that they have had to fence their properties, put up new security doors, gates, and cameras, that sort of thing, security cameras, or even in the case of commercial property owners, hire security patrols who drive by and do that sort of thing. Mm. It's all that kind of category of improving security.
Yeah. So I said most of the complaints there seem to have come from Tucson. That said, there have not been that many complaints, but how many are coming from your city?
So it's a little we don't have up-to-date data. The data we have goes through October 15th. So the law was passed in November 24 and went into effect early 25. And so through the first 9.5 months of the year, there were 24 complaints under the law, and 15 of them came from Tucson. That is 24 complaints statewide. I should clarify.
Yeah.
And 15 of them came from Tucson, which that's 60 some percent of the complaints, whereas Tucson only has 7% of the state's population.
Yes, that's notable. Okay. So let's talk about the city's response here, because you report that they are rejecting them all, basically. Why?
Yeah. I mean, in all the three rejections that I've seen, and apparently they've done 9 so far, they cite a series of reasons, one of which is generally that the people are asking for too much money, more than allowed under the law. Another is that they are not reporting a qualified nuisance, because the nuisances are enumerated in the law. Another will be that they most importantly, they reject the law overall.
Right.
The city says the law is unconstitutional under Arizona's constitution. So they told me they've received 9 complaints and responded to them and have rejected them all so far.
Hmm. Okay. So the city is saying, we don't think this law is constitutional, so we are not going to honor it, essentially.
That's the way I read it. Yeah, I mean, they told me that they're reserving their rights in case of by saying that they're just reserving their rights in case of litigation. But the way I read it is, if you say the law is unconstitutional, then you're going to reject every one.
So, what recourse would residents have against that in that case?
Yeah, they can file in the county superior court that they're in. So basically, the city of Tucson in this case is daring people to sue. And nobody has so far. But of course, now that Goldwater is aware of what's going on, I won't be surprised if they support some response to the city of Tucson.
That's interesting. Okay, so you outlined some specific examples of complaints coming from Tucson. Tell us about those in more detail and the city's specific response.
Well, yeah, in this column that you referred to, I quoted somebody. Now, I should mention that these names and identifying information are redacted in all the public records that the Department of Revenue has released so far. But, for example, there's one person who requested $2,025, more or less, from the city of Tucson, saying that they had been broken into by people who were camped nearby and had packages stolen from them, and that they had had to do gate repairs, a security door, security cameras, et cetera. And, you know, the city responded and said that they had not demonstrated a pattern of the city not enforcing its laws as required under the law. But more, the thing that I find really fascinating and a bit troubling is that under the law, you can only recover the amount up to the amount of primary property tax that you mm-hmm. paid to the given jurisdiction the previous year.
Right.
In a county, if you're living in county, not a city, then you may be paying a lot in primary property tax. But in the city of Tucson, this person was requesting $2,000-some of reimbursement, but they had only paid $145 to the city of Tucson in primary property tax the previous year. Hmm. So you can keep collecting that year over year, but you know, first you have to get the expenses approved, and that may take a lawsuit. And then you have to keep filing every year until you get up to your approved amount.
Right. So tell us about homelessness in Tucson, Tim. Like I wonder what the backstory is here. We in Phoenix, when we were focused on homeless encampments, you know, it was much focused around the zone, this kind of really major encampment around downtown Phoenix that the city was kind of ordered to clean up. What's the situation looked like in Tucson? Like, why do you think a lot of these complaints are coming from that city?
I mean, it's possible that there's more awareness of the law and such, and that's skewing the filings. But my best guess is that it's because the city has a more pervasive and also probably less concentrated problem with camps and the problems that relate to camps, such as drug use, sometimes petty crime, and defecation, et cetera, that comes with it. So, yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's a kind of a pervasive problem around the city, not concentrated in a place like the zone or mm-hmm. anything like that.
Yeah. What has the city's response been to that broader problem? Like, how would they tackle it? Yeah.
They certainly have an argument. I mean, they take complaints regularly. They respond to complaints. They have been removing camps, et cetera. But, you know, there's an underlying problem that they have not been able to solve, which is that, you know, there's people who are addicted to drugs or without a home or both, or are seriously mentally ill and unable to sustain a home. And there's just not a place or a way so far. We haven't been able to house enough of those people. I mean, there's been a little progress, but there seems the problem seems to increase apace with the solution.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. Tim Steller joining us from the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. Tim, thank you so as always. I appreciate it.
Last month, Senator Ruben Gallego introduced the One Fair Price Act, a bill which his office says would, quote, prevent companies from setting individualized prices based on consumers' personal data and allow small businesses to better compete with large companies on the quality of their product, not the use of exploitive pricing practices, end quote. When Gallego visited the studio recently, I asked him for an example of the type of exploitation he thinks this legislation is necessary to address.
For example, you know, with the advent of basically being able to buy your tickets online, social media, and now with AI being very ever present, you can basically go online to be talking about the fact you just had a newborn or you know, a grandson was born, and then you start looking for airline tickets. That airline ticket will be able to figure out that you are very excited about going to, for example, Chicago to see your grandson.
Right.
And instead of pricing it based on the supply and demand of seats, they'll price it on the fact that they know that you are very excited to go, and they'll figure out what is your price point. So they're going to keep rising the price until they figure out like how much they can maximize profits out of you. That is not capitalism. That is being predatory.
So let me make sure people really understand this, because I appreciate that example you gave, and I think this can sound a little conceptual to some people.
Right.
I can go on Instagram
and
I can say, I have a new grandson in Chicago.
Can't wait to see him.
Can't wait to see him, thinking that I'm just talking to my Instagram followers about this. I'm actually talking to, say, Delta Airlines unwittingly, who the next time I go to the Delta Airlines website and try to buy a ticket to Chicago, they will somehow know that I am particularly excited to get to Chicago and they might tick my price up a little bit for the privilege of getting me there.
Exactly. Now, when you brought up Delta actually did say this at one of their corporate shareholder meetings. And the CEO said that they're going to particularly institute this type of pricing, if I remember correctly, to find the particular pain point that someone's willing to pay.
They use that language.
They use that language, yes. Now, They have since retracted. But, you know, when you're saying this to as a CEO, when you're saying to your corporate shareholders, you know, you're basically saying that this is the way we're going to maximize profits. As you know, the CEOs have to maximize profits. But this is where the government has to step in, because we want to make sure that the consumer has just as much of a chance at getting the best price as the companies.
Elsewhere in our conversation, Senator Gallego referenced a recent investigation by Consumer Reports, which looked at the way this type of pricing has been used by grocery apps. They wrote up their findings for an article published in late December, and the piece sent shockwaves through the grocery industry. Consumer Reports investigators focused primarily on the app Instacart and revealed that the company was using algorithmic pricing to experiment with the cost of common items. After my conversation with Senator Gallego, I spoke to the lead reporter on that investigation, Derek Kravitz.
The capabilities are you know, seemingly endless. We actually looked at their patents, Instacart and the small AI company they acquired, Eversight. And the patents make clear that they can sort of hoover up all of this personal data about you and create this crazy good personal dossier. We've actually received some of those from consumers, where you live, your phone number, your email address, but also how much money you make, how many people are in your household, whether you're married.
And so from a practical standpoint, what this means is that an app like Instacart, which for people who don't know is a virtual grocery shopping app, I might be shopping for bagels. And yeah. I don't know why I picked bagels, but I love bagels. So I might put some bagels into my shopping cart on Instacart, and somebody in the apartment next to mine might be adding the same bag of bagels from the same store to their shopping cart, and we might be looking at different prices.
Yes. And generally speaking, you know, all the prices through Instacart and many other e-commerce platforms are constantly being toggled and tweaked and changed in order to find, you know, your perfect willingness to pay, the highest price that you are willing to spend on an individual product based on all of this data, all of these factors.
And so tell us, based on what you found, about the range of price differences that users might be seeing in markets where this kind of experimentation is happening.
Yeah. So to understand how people are grouped and sorted into, you know, different price groups by Instacart, we had more than 400 volunteers across the country join us on live online shopping sessions from different areas of the country. And we had them put in, you know, the same 18 or 20 odd grocery items in their baskets and had them screenshot and check prices. What we found was that, you know, at the highest level, some products like Skippy peanut butter or various types of cereal or eggs, the price variance could be as high as 23%. Not all products were algorithmically changed, but we saw that the three quarters of products, 75% of products that were changed in our testing, the average change was about 13%, right? And then that resulted in a total basket change of about 7%. And 7% over the course of a year for a family of four can add up to $1,200.
Right, of course. We're talking about groceries here, right? So this is the kind of shopping trip that this isn't like a one-off purchase. These are ostensibly the kinds of shopping trips that families make on a weekly basis.
Exactly. It's not furniture. It's not a car. It's, you know, it's things, essentials. Hmm. So Instacart did announce right before the holidays that they have stopped price experiments in response to this investigation. But the caveat or the loophole there is that they will continue price experiments with promotions and discounts.
Okay. So they're saying basically that they will continue to do the experiments, but only in ways that would theoretically benefit the consumer as opposed to costing them extra money.
Yes, that's right.
And are you aware, Derek, I mean, we've been talking about Instacart specifically because that's the company that your investigation looked at, but there must be other companies that are experimenting with similar tech.
Yes. A ton of retailers have, you know, taken notice of the ability to algorithmically change prices and to do so with personal data and buyer behavior, you know, in hand. You know, not just in the grocery space, but you know, any other retailer you can think of. Obviously, Amazon and Walmart sort of, you know, created this market in this, you know, data science, so to speak. But others have caught on. You know, one grocery retailer, the second or third largest by most metrics in the country, Kroger, has a data science unit within its company with clean rooms and, you know, rooms where first party data is collected and then joined or shared with other data that they buy from data brokers. Extremely sophisticated tech for a company that operates a, you know, a chain of grocery stores.
Well, I have been speaking with Derek Kravitz, who is an investigative journalist and published this investigation with his colleagues at Consumer Reports. Derek, thank you for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the cultural significance of a 1930s grocery store turned tortilla shop in Tucson and what threatens its existence.
But first, the Democratic National Committee made a big announcement last week alongside Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego that they are launching their largest ever voter registration effort right here in Arizona.
There is no pathway to victory for Democrats going into the future without Nevada and without Arizona as part of the Electoral College.
Democrats have been losing ground in the voter registration game to Republicans for years now. Gallego pointed out that Republicans increased their registration advantage over Democrats by 115,000 voters just over the course of his 2024 campaign. And while he was successful anyway, not many other Democrats in Arizona were. But this registration gap has been growing for years, and our next guest this morning has been sounding the alarm about it all along. Stacey Pearson is a Democratic strategist with Lumen Strategies, and she told me it's about time.
I am so glad that this is being prioritized in Arizona after a number of years that the Democratic registration numbers were going in the wrong direction. And so is it enough? Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, I think $1 million is a great start. We probably need $10 million to get back to where we were.
Right. So you have been sounding the alarm from the Democratic side for years now, Stacey, about kind of just how far behind the Democrats are getting in voter registration numbers in our state. Tell us about the kind of trends. Like, there was a point at which it didn't look so bad and then it's gotten kind of worse and worse for Democrats, right?
Exactly. There was a point that Democrats had more registered voters on the rolls than independents did. And not only have we fallen to third place, but it's a distant third. Mm-hmm. So you've got Republicans as the largest party, independents is a close second. And then 500,000 voters later are Democrats in Arizona compared to the top two. So it is a big deficit, and it is one that legitimately keeps me up at night.
When did this begin for Democrats?
So it really started in 2020, 2022 is when the numbers of Democrats registering to vote stopped ascending the way it had been. And in 2016, Democrats had great gains. In 2018, we had great gains. 2020, 2022, and then definitely in 2024 is when we saw a statistically significant drop off.
Hmm. Was it people leaving the party, or was it more people registering as Republicans or independents?
So part of the problem is we don't know. The Democrats did not invest in that data. And so we certainly know that voters moving to Arizona, I talk about my neighbors all the time. I'm sorry, Katie, that I'm mentioning you again, but you know, it's residents of California that moved to Arizona during COVID that were mad about things, mad about how much they're paying in taxes, mad about crime and public safety, mad about things. And they were lifelong Democrats registered as Arizona and as independents or even Republicans. And we never really got into that world to figure out what they left the Democratic Party because of. We made lots of presumptions. And so it's people moving to, it's inbound migration from red states, it's inbound migration from blue states, it's newly registered young voters, which we saw Turning Point's impact on young men last cycle. And it's folks that are just mad at the system. And that combination has proved to be extraordinarily unhelpful for registered Democrats in the state of Arizona.
Hmm. So the DNC says here it specifically wants to target Latino voters in Arizona. They say there are 700,000 unregistered Latino voters in the state that are maybe up for grabs. They want to get on their side. But the Latino vote has been fickle. A lot of Latinos turned out for Trump in 2024, which surprised a lot of people. Also, I wonder, like, is this a voting block we can call a voting block anymore, like the Latino vote, quote unquote?
So I think assuming a block of voters from a variety of countries vote as one is short-sighted. So I would say that we really need to dig into the Latino voter, quote unquote, by how long they've been here. What was their country of origin? We don't separate other blocks out in quite the same way. And I think we're naive to think we can control a block of voters that are truly lumped together by the shade of their skin. So the Latino vote is extraordinarily important, and particularly going into 2026 after what's happening in Minnesota and the ICE raids that are incoming to Arizona. The Hispanic voter is particularly angry about the bill of goods that they were sold by the Trump administration that they certainly haven't been delivering on, honestly.
So you think there is a path there in some ways?
I do. I mean, these are the folks that are getting harassed on the street. We're talking about 1070 all over again.
Wow. Yeah.
It really is a worst case scenario for the community. And I think that is going to impact how they turn out and how they register in Arizona.
Okay, so Stacey, what could or should you think a DNC major voter registration effort look like here in Arizona? Where do they go? How do you do this right in 2026?
So two things. One, I think going and talking to the Latino voter, to the Hispanic voter, is extraordinarily important right now, and figuring out where they got away from us 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, though, is going to the newly registered voters in Arizona, either people who were Arizona registered and switched away from the Democratic Party, or moved here and switched away from the Democratic Party, and getting those folks back, figuring out what their grievance was, addressing it, being honest with them about what possible solutions could look like. I mean, those are the voters. They were once ours, and then they left, mm-hmm. and we need to bring them home.
Okay. So obviously, that big voter registration advantage for Republicans we watched kind of play out in the 2024 election. What do you think it could look like if it doesn't turn around for Democrats in the midterms coming up in 2026 or even into 2028?
I think we're going to look at history repeating itself in 2016, for example, in Maricopa County, when Paul Pinzon beat Joe Arpaio because of Joe Arpaio's ham-handed immigration enforcement. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see people really base their decisions, base their ballots on their personal moral fabric. And anyone watching people die of a lack of insulin accessibility in ICE detention centers can recognize that that is simply wrong.
Hmm. Okay. Stacey Pearson, Democratic strategist with Lumen Strategies, joining us. Stacey, thanks as always. Appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Northern Arizona University has paused their plan to open a College of Medicine. Originally announced to great fanfare in 2023, NAU now says economic uncertainty and the tense climate around higher education policies necessitate putting the college on hold. While the school still offers a nursing program, which graduated nearly 800 students last year, our next guest says the pause creates a potential gap in vital health coverage around the state. Will Humble is the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. We spoke to him back in 2023 when NAU announced the plans for the College of Medicine. At the time, he called it, quote, exactly what the state needs. He joins us again this morning to react to this news. Will, good morning.
Morning. How you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for being here. So remind us why you felt this program was such a promising step. A major factor was that it would have focused on primary care, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So all three universities put out a plan. It was called Healthy Arizona Tomorrow. So U of A had their plan for what they wanted to do, which is just basically double the number of medical students running through there. ASU has their plan, which is focused on sort of high-tech integration of engineering and medicine, still a specialty focus.
Right.
But if you look at what are the key healthcare needs in Arizona, it's really primary care. And that's what NAU's plan focused on. It focused on building the inventory of primary care medical students, and importantly, clinical rotations and residency slots in the rural parts of the state, not just the rural, tribal as well. And so the NAU plan hit the nail right on the head,
right,
and it provided all the incentives that you need to get folks to choose primary care as their specialty.
Yeah,
because it provided debt relief.
Let's also talk about a couple of the other ones. One of the other things is it would have moved students through medical school in about 3 years, right?
Right. It moves them through medical school in 3 years with less cost, and had the had rotations and residency slots when they graduate to help them get that clinical experience in the rural parts of the state that need primary care so much. So that's why it's so sad to see, of all the three plans, NAU's was the best by far, and it's the one that's going to go down the drain, it sounds like.
We'll talk a little bit about that focus on rural areas. There was also an emphasis on cultural competency, things like behavioral health. These also were very distinct in terms of what this program would have focused on, right?
Right. It went right down the line. You could tell the NAU did their homework, and they said they started from the right place, which is like, what is it that we need as a university up in the northern part of the state? What is it that we need? And they hit it. They identified exactly what we need in order to improve the health status of folks in rural Arizona. And they built a plan that would have done exactly that. And right now it's the one that's, they say paused. I hope that doesn't mean canceled.
And help folks make the connection between the financial incentives this program would have offered and why that has a direct impact on more medical students going into primary care.
Yeah, great question. So, medical school is expensive.
Yes.
And
Breaking news.
Unless you have wealthy parents or grandparents, like, you're going to end up taking out some loans. And when you're a doctor, like, you are going to make more money if you're a specialist like a ENT or a heart surgeon or a neurologist or something like that. You're going to get paid more, which means you can pay your loans back more quickly. If you're in pediatrics, family medicine, primary care, you're not going to make the same salary. You get rewarded in other ways
because sure,
you're really making a huge difference, but you don't make the same salary. And so if you come out with a lot of debt, when you're finished with medical school, you get pushed into specialties that you might rather have gone into primary care, but the financial reality is, I gotta specialize so I can get rid of these loans.
Right, right.
So, an NAU's program was A, less expensive over the course of time, B, provided the residency slots and incentives to practice in rural areas, financial incentives too. So I hope somehow it comes back.
Well, we have just about a minute left here, Will, and I want to ask you, Arizona did just receive $167 million in federal money for rural health specifically. That was not as much money as people hoped. It was actually the sixth lowest, I believe, allocation in the country. Will that money help fill the gap that the pause of this program is leaving? How do you see these things interacting?
Depends on where the governor's office ends up focusing that $167 million. We asked for $200 million. We got $167 million. The governor's office is in the process of saying what we're not going to do that we had planned to do. I met with the policy advisor just last week and urged him, please don't cut what you had planned to do with residency positions. And so hopefully they don't cut that. But this rural health transformation grant, if it continues over 5 years, gives whoever is the next governor 4 years in order to decide, look, we want that NAU plan. We need that inventory of primary care folks. We're going to fund the NAU system, which would become self-sustaining. It is sustainable if you get that bolus of investment up front.
Last question for you, Will, very quickly. Can you just paint a picture for us? What is the state of primary care in Arizona? Like, how many primary care doctors do we need?
So it depends where you live. So like if you live in, Phoenix or Scottsdale, here in the Valley or in the center part of Tucson, there's primary care. There's people at the community health centers that you can go see. As you get into the rural, and nurse practitioners, not always MDs, nurse high practitioners actually make really good primary care folks. But if you're in the rural parts of the state,
right,
that's where the real, the lack of care is. And so there's no single answer. So many listeners will say, well, I don't have a problem making my appointment.
Exactly.
And I don't either. Right. I go to Mountain Park Health Center and I get my appointments real easy. But as you get into more rural spots, it's harder and harder to find somebody to help you manage your diabetes or blood pressure or stuff like that.
Well, as you say, for now, the program is just on pause. We'll see how the situation develops. I've been speaking with Will Humble, who is the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Will, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Abraham Quintanilla, the father of the singer Selena, passed away this past December at the age of 86. Quintanilla was a controversial figure. He sensed early on that his daughter had the potential to be a star and pushed Selena and her siblings hard to achieve what he saw as their full potential. Over the years, in movie adaptations of Selena's tragic story, Quintanilla has been portrayed as domineering, controlling, and inflexible. But our next guest says that's not the whole story. Hector Saldana is the music curator of the Whitliff Collection at Texas State University, and he's also a longtime music journalist. Back in the early 90s, Saldana got to know Quintanilla well through his reporting on Selena's meteoric rise and her shocking murder. He and Quintanilla kept talking after those initial stories. Saldana says Quintanilla wasn't just a source, he was a friend. He also says that while a lot of the harsher stories about Quintanilla have some truth to them, they don't reveal the full picture of the man Saldana knew. Quintanilla, Saldana told me, was a loving father and a passionate musician in his own right.
You know, his group in the 1950s was the original Dinos. They were an English singing group trying to emulate the sounds on the radio. They later switched and sang in Spanish. They were pioneers in that sense. If you did not have, you know, this American Chicano kid in love with Elvis and the rock and roll of that original era, there would never have been a Selena. And I think he lived his dream through his daughter.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting to me, that little detail that his band was called, as you were just saying, when he was a young man, the Dinos, and the family band that he later put together was, if I'm not mistaken, Selena and the Dinos. So he kept the name.
Yeah, Los Dinos, you know, to give it a little more Latin flair. And, you know, it's almost like a Mexican-American Partridge Family, you know, trying to emerge out of Corpus Christi.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I imagine there's going to be some people listening to this who know who Selena is, maybe even love her music. Maybe they've seen one of the biopics. But even if that's the case, they may have this perception of Abraham Quintanilla as a certain kind of, you know, in terms of the way he was portrayed, manipulative, patriarchal figure.
You're fired!
Dad, you can't fire him! Dad, we're in love!
You're not in love. Get on the bus.
No, Selena.
We are, man. Come on. We were going to tell you.
Dad,
you have money
stop.
To call someone?
Dad,
I don't know.
No,
get on the bus.
Get in the bus. Mom,
what can you tell us to introduce us to maybe a little bit more nuanced version of him? I know that it's not that he was not hard-edged in some ways, but I get the sense from what you're saying that there was more to it than that.
There was more to it than that. He could be stern and very protective, but also, when Selena, who later became the queen of Tejano music, when they first started out, I mean, it really was a building program. You know, I mean, it had such humble beginnings in playing the lousiest kind of gigs and just trying to cobble it together on a shoestring budget. And then as she sort of emerged, she was not a novelty act, but it was novel in the Tejano genre to have such a young person, to have a female in this male-dominated music form. And so, you know, I'm a father myself, so he was protective of his daughters. And I think you could really get him to open up when he talked about his days with his original Dinos. Uh-huh. But I think that all those sort of, you know, didn't quite reach the brass ring with that band, that he wanted to try to get it right this time.
And I mean, was there ever a sense that he and Selena had a bad relationship?
No, not really. We really need to look at Abraham Quintanilla in the way that we look at someone like Joe Jackson of the the Jackson family,
sure,
or Pop Staples, even or even Murray Wilson, the father of the Wilson brothers and the Beach Boys, this sort of protective overlay and influential, because Selena as a young girl is being influenced by Madonna, by Donna Summers, by Janet Jackson very much. But yet, if you think of Abraham as sort of old school musician, and I think it's that chemistry, in other words, the youthful energy that Selena brought and the natural talent,
yeah,
and also and that new generation vibe with a little bit of what, Pop was telling her. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think they went hand in hand.
I'm imagining the first time you talk to him, just like, the first time you talk to any source, you feel like they're kind of saying what they got in touch with this journalist to say. But obviously, ideally over time, you get to a point where you can talk to them like they're real selves, or at least something close to it. Did you ever have a moment in your conversations with Abraham where you felt like you got there, where he answered a question or said something to you and you thought to yourself, like, that's the real guy?
One incident that comes into mind in particular, in the mid-1990s, Showtime, the network, had launched a series called the Latino Laugh Festival, and it debuted and was taped in front of live audiences in San Antonio at various venues. This was about 1996 and 97. It carried on for about 3 years in that original format with, people like George Lopez and Daisy Fuentes and the notorious Carlos Mencia. Well, Carlos Mencia made a tasteless joke about Selena on stage. I was in the theater and so was Abraham. And I saw this bear of a man get up and start to head toward the doors. And you see Mencia leave, exiting, and I tried to follow as best I could. And I mean, I was thinking this guy's going to wring his neck. And, the scuttlebutt was that, Carlos was kind of hiding out.
Well, and I have to think if that Showtime series you were just mentioning was airing in like 96 or 97, I mean, that would have been very soon after Selena's murder.
Yeah, it's too soon. That wound was very real. Yeah. And also, Abraham confided to me more than once that he blamed himself for being protective at the wrong time, that he was not protective when it mattered.
What was behind that? How did he explain that to you?
Well, he recognized in himself that sometimes he was very overprotective, but he just felt that he just did not see the danger that lurked, with Yolanda Saldivar, her murderer.
And let me just say, for listeners who aren't aware, Yolanda had been the president of Selena's fan club.
Yes. So he hired her. Selena, at the time of her death, you have to understand, she was chasing her dreams with fashion. There was a couple of stores that carried her fashion line. Her father wasn't too hip to that. Yolanda was brought in to kind of oversee a little bit of that. That's what happened. She was part of the fan club, but then she was brought in to oversee the clothing line.
Right.
And so right away, other people around Selena noticed the bad vibes from this woman, but somehow the father didn't.
Yeah. Well, and I have to imagine that must have been so complicated for Abraham, because I know there's the famous story of how he reacted when he found out that Selena had been dating her bandmate, he didn't even want them to hold hands, and they famously had to elope without his knowledge in order to get married. So, I mean, is that what he was referring to, that he felt like once she had passed away, he had sort of been protective in the wrong ways?
Well, protective since they were children, what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, he did, that reputation was not something that he hadn't earned. He was a protective father. He was old school, just in the way it turned out that it was just, they were so close. They had achieved a big part of that dream. And then to just have it snuffed out by something that was really there lurking almost in plain sight.
Yeah.
It's very painful. I mean, it's painful for me to even remember that and think about that and contemplate that.
Well, I have been speaking with Hector Saldana, who is a longtime music journalist who covered Selena and her father, Abraham Quintanilla, for many years. Hector, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you very much.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. A new list aims to shine light on 13 sites with historic significance to the Latinx community. The 2025 Endangered Latinx Landmarks Report includes a Texas cemetery, a bar in L.A., agricultural labor housing in Colorado, and a market in Tucson. This is the first list of its kind the group Latinos in Heritage Conservation has released. Selah Mota Casper is its executive director. She spoke with our co-host, Mark Brody, and they started with what the thinking was behind doing this.
What we know is that Latinx landmarks throughout the country are being demolished at such a rapid rate, in a faster rapid rate than any other cultural resources throughout the United States. So the Endangered Landmarks list was really to call attention to that, to say that there are so many significant sites, and in this case, we selected 13 sites across the U.S. That embodied various different types of historical themes, but also really big threats, like demolition. And so this listing, being the inaugural list, was really to bring wide attention to these types of issues that's occurring in every state, including Arizona.
Why is it that these kinds of historic landmarks are being demolished or destroyed more quickly than those maybe of other communities?
Yeah, a lot of it is that no one is focused on saving Latinx places at this point. There's a lot of issues whenever we think about what is history, what is valued as history, what's an important historical site, what's an important architectural site, cultural site. And because those items can be so subjective, it makes it really hard sometimes for people to recognize just how significant or important a regular mundane site could be to, you know, your local historical narrative or state narrative. And they can face anything from like threatened by demolition, deterioration, rising costs, and lack of investment. And so because there's lack of resources actually given to these types of sites and lack of attention, people just think that they're tear-me-downs and that they should be torn down and not really looked at for what makes it truly important.
So you mentioned that this process is somewhat subjective. So I'm curious, like when you were looking through the nominations, what were you looking for to determine, yes, this is historic, yes, this does need to be protected, this does need to be on a list to try to draw attention to preserve it?
Yeah, absolutely. We looked at multiple things. We looked at the stories that were embodied in each of these places. We looked at the memory and the identity of each community and what they represented to each community. And there were also stories that aren't really talked about in Latinx communities. We selected an LGBTQIA site. We selected a site associated with farm workers. We selected, you know, an old market within a barrio. And so these are stories that can play a role in our everyday lives and everyday history, yet people don't realize how important they are to our broader narrative.
Is part of the goal with this, in addition to drawing attention to the specific sites, to maybe in some way draw attention to the idea of landmarks, of historic places associated with this community broadly?
That's right. Yeah. When we lose a historical site, and we purposefully called it a landmark because within historic preservation, you have different sites that are designated as, you know, this is a historic site. This is a national historic landmark. This is a protected landmark. And so just in the naming of itself, we intentionally chose endangered Latinx landmarks to be able to share that, okay, these places may not be in a traditional registry, but they are a landmark to the community. And when we lose those landmarks, we're not just losing bricks and mortar, we're not just losing an old building, we're losing that memory. And, you know, those buildings really are cultural anchors, they're classrooms, they're symbols of resilience, they're places where history happened and occurred. And so saving these sites really just ensures that we have these for future generations and that children can actually learn from them, adults can learn from them, and really understand the full American experience.
So it's interesting you mentioned that they're classrooms, that they're sort of living places, because the location that you mentioned in Arizona that's on the list, Anita Street Market, is very much that, right? Like, it's still a store that people can go into, and it serves as a market. So I wonder, like, what is the hope by putting that a landmark on this list in terms of preserving it, but also, you know, making it so that it continues to be able to serve its purpose and serve its community into the future?
Absolutely. We were so excited to be able to highlight Anita Street Market in Tucson. Tucson is such a historically and culturally rich city. And when we were looking at Anita's, what we loved about it is that it was nestled within this old historic barrio, and it was established in the 30s. It's woman-owned, and it was passed on from, you know, Chinese history and now to Mexican-American history. And so with this site, we wanted to say that there are lots of different legacy businesses, heritage businesses, multi-generational businesses like Anita's that are so important and that are struggling. Anita's itself was dealing with some issues that needed a lot of rehabilitation work. And so we really wanted to highlight that, yes, that Tucson is known for being a UNESCO city of gastronomy, but the gastronomy is about the people, right? It's about the culture and the anchors there. And in this case, it's Anita Street Market, which is an old historical market where people used to be able to walk into and buy food, buy fresh tortillas, be able to get there. And so we still see it as being a community anchor. And because we know that it is threatened by things like food gentrification or displacement because of all of the rapid growth that's happening there in Tucson, we really wanted to shine a light that this place, as small and as beautiful as this building is really important to the community. And we hear you and we applaud the work that the community is doing, trying to preserve it. And so we wanted to share that story and just share that this place, along with other places similar to it, are very much worth preserving. And then we also wanted Americans at large just to know that Latinx history is vast. It's part of American history. And there is a multitude of various faces that it looks like, including, you know, a tortillera where you can go in and get fresh tortillas.
So given sort of where the economy is now, and given the fact that, you know, most historic preservation budgets are not overflowing with dollars, what realistic goals do you have for this list? Like, what's a reasonable expectation for the impact of being on this list for the places that are?
We've already seen the impact occur since we announced this listing. Anita's itself has seen more foot traffic over the last few weeks, and they were so grateful for it. Because of this listing, they were able to use this as a catalyst to get a grant. So there's a lot of things that happen, but the biggest thing is really just having that big national call, sharing that these sites are out there, they're threatened and they're endangered, and that they need our community's help.
All right. That is Sayla Mota Casper, Executive Director of Latinos in Heritage Conservation. Sayla, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for listening to the show this morning. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show. You can also sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org.
It is a great read, I will say for myself, although I am biased. You should join
I'll second that. I'll second that.
That'll do it for today's edition of The Show. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to The Show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.